Good afternoon. Welcome to the EcoNews Report. I'm your host this week, Jennifer Kalt, Director of Humboldt Baykeeper. The EcoNews Report is brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, EcoNews. Today, my guest is Dr. Don Goley, professor of zoology and director of the Humboldt State University Marine Mammal Stranding Program, who's here today to speak about lessons learned from studying stranded marine mammals in Northern California. Thanks so much for being on the EcoNews Report today.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start out talking about the Humboldt State University Marine Mammal Stranding Program. What is it and what does it do exactly?
So the stranding program has been in operation at HSU in the biology department since the inception of Humboldt State. So in the late 60s, early 70s, we started responding to public calls for marine mammals, and we were collecting those marine mammals and using them in the Vertebrate Museum. And that's used for both education and research. I came in 1996, and we had a number of students who became involved in the stranding program. And then as recently as 5 years ago, we've started a different phase of that program. So the marine mammal stranding program, the goal of it is to respond to reports of dead marine mammals and to learn what we can from their stranding.
So back then in the 1960s, was there a marine mammal expert here at Humboldt State?
Yeah, Dr. Jake Houck was the marine mammalogist then, and he retired 3 or 4 years before I was hired here in 1996.
Very interesting. I didn't know that it dated back that long.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what you do. I mean, how do you find stranded marine mammals?
Well, we do it in two ways. One is we have a great community outreach program, and a number of community members give us a call when they find something dead on the beach. And then we respond to that and identify it to species and take all the measurements we need to do. And then two, we have an effort-based program where I have a number of undergraduate and graduate students who walk pretty much every beach in Humboldt County and some in Del Norte and some in Mendocino every month and record what they do or don't see. And that program enables us to get a better baseline understanding of what normal stranding patterns are. And it gets all the students out on the beach and excited to find something new and exciting. Yeah, I'd say that the stranding program had a big shift after 1972 with the authorization of the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And so part of that was to protect species in the wild and to try to recover populations that had been decimated by whaling. But the other component of that was that there is a mandate to study stranded marine mammals as well. And so it became more of a formalized study in 1972. And then in 1996, the act was revised. And so we sort of entered a new phase of marine mammal stranding science after that.
What was the original intent, would you say, back in 1972 of studying stranded marine mammals?
Well, I guess the idea is that it's one thing to study marine mammals at sea. There's quite a lot of challenges involved with that. But that the animals that you'll see on the beaches that are stranded, you can learn a lot from, and you can make some inferences about what's happening in wild populations by understanding what's happening on the beach.
Yeah, I imagine it's probably pretty difficult to find whales in the ocean. But when they wash up on the beach, obviously, they're a lot easier to spot.
Right. And the challenge there is that when they're stranded, it could be because they've been sick or injured or any number of reasons that marine mammals strand. And so it can and cannot be a great index for what's happening at the sea. But stranded marine mammals are a good indicator of ocean health. If you have some oceanographic event like an El Nino or domoic acid bloom or those sorts of things occurring offshore, it's a really probably one of the early warning signs to something bigger happening offshore. They can be an indication of some human interaction that is detrimental to them. So getting entangled in fishing gear, having some interaction with boats of some sort, so that we can then mitigate that problem by working with the fishing community to sort of see if we can assist the marine mammals in that case. And it can be this conservation avenue as well. So we can learn about conservation of species by understanding animals on the beach.
I imagine most people are picturing whales, but you're mm-hmm. talking about all kinds of marine mammals, right? Give a sense for what other kinds of marine mammals you find stranded.
Well, I think we've had over 25 species of marine mammals that have stranded along the North Coast. And they include things from our biggest one was a blue whale, fin whales, humpback whales, gray whales, killer whales. So we do have our share of big whales, but we also have a large number of harbor porpoise and smaller cetaceans, so the whales and dolphins that strand. We have a significant number of California sea lions, harbor seals that are resident here or come here that strand. We just found an elephant seal this week on the beach, a number of seals and sea lions, but we also had two sea otters that have stranded here. And we did the genetic work on them and found that one was from the northern population and one was coming up from the southern population. So young males that are leaving their natal habitat, which was pretty interesting. We've had sea turtles strand. So we respond to those as well for fish and wildlife. We've had, you know, random things like cows and beavers and deer and all sorts of things that strand.
Eating mammals.
Cars. We found a car once. Yeah. So, yeah. So the students find a lot of really interesting things on the beach, but we only do sort of dedicated science on the marine mammals that strand.
Tell us a little bit about how you document them and the trends that you're finding, the kinds of numbers that you find.
Yeah. Well, let me put it in a little bit of context for you. And we're part of a national marine mammal stranding network. And so we are part of what's called the Western region. So all of the stranding hubs in California, Oregon, and Washington, and along any coastline, send their data and their information to a centralized source. So at any time, the managers in NOAA can get an idea of what the stranding patterns are around the country. And I think that's one of the biggest strengths is the sort of community aspect of the scientific community in NOAA. So that's one aspect of how we communicate within these areas. And so that enables us to determine unusual mortality events like the California sea lion die-off that's just kind of finished up, which is great. There was a Guadalupe fur seal die-off. If you were just walking your own beach and you found one or two, you just wouldn't have an idea if you're part of a bigger problem, an ocean-wide problem. And so that's what we get to do by being part of this larger network.
So you work with other marine mammalogists all over the West Coast of North America?
Yeah, the West Coast and the East Coast. So we just had a national meeting in D.C. where we were able to come together and pool our resources and our minds to sort of figure out what the next steps for the marine mammal stranding network.
Well, since you mentioned the sea lion die-off, why don't we talk a little bit about that? Because that's been in the news quite a bit and people are pretty concerned about that.
Yeah. So this was a California sea lion die-off and it happened at the same time that we had a large El Nino event. And so an El Nino event is just when you have really warm water, it lowers productivity. And that means it lowers everything from the phytoplankton and zooplankton and the fish that are feeding on that. And then the top predators, which in this case are the sea lions. So California sea lion females breed down in the Channel Islands with the males, obviously. What sea lions do, their life history is kind of different in that they give birth on land. And then after a short period of time, the moms leave the pups and go away to forage and then come back. And what was happening was the females would leave the pups for longer and longer periods of time to find food. And then they wouldn't find as much food and they'd be away for a lot longer. And so the pups were starving in essence. And so the pups would leave the rookeries or either die on the rookeries or leave the rookeries and then eventually die on land. And so both the females who are trying to nurse as well as gather enough food were emaciated and they were suffering in the die-off as well as the pups. And so a lot of that was happening closer down to sort of Southern California and Central California where the live responders were collecting all these emaciated animals and trying to help rehabilitate them and release them. And the dead responders were just recording and collecting the dead ones.
There's the live responders and the dead responders, and those are two different organizations?
Yeah, they're all members of the Marine Mammal Stranding Network, the national network. And then up here, we work as a partner with the North Coast Marine Mammal Center, which is centered up in Crescent City. And then they're responsible for live strandings in Del Norte and Humboldt County. And then we're responsible for dead strandings in Del Norte, Humboldt, and Mendocino County. And then below us, the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito takes over and Calicad takes over for the next stretch of coast. So each stretch of coast has a steward associated with it. Given that we're so remote up here, we work really closely with the live stranding network and they let us know when they hear about dead things and we let them know when we hear about nearly dead things. So,
aww.
Yeah, but it's interesting because the live stranding networks get to learn more about the sort of real pathology of it and what's going on internally and have a lot of veterinary science going on. And we have sort of the other end where we're trying to sort of decipher what could have been the cause of death through taking samples and that sort of thing.
So it strikes me that when something like this happens with the big California sea lion die-off, it takes scientists a while to try and understand what's happening and why.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that for the general public who may wonder, well, how can it take 2 years to figure out or whatever, how many years to figure out what's happening and why?
Right. Well, I think that's the beauty of being in a community of scientists, you know, and that's something that the Baykeeper is really good about, too, is that you have this larger community. And so for us, we were working with our colleagues at NOAA that were studying the ocean patterns. So we had a kind of feeling that it was going to have some impact on the whole ecosystem. ecosystem. And then we worked with our colleagues up at NOAA, the Marine Mammal Center up in Seattle, who were studying the sea lions on their rookeries in the Channel Islands. And so we had some sort of heads up that this was coming our way. So it's interesting when you work with the diverse community of scientists, how you can put this puzzle together relatively quickly. And given that we were this really well-organized network, we were able to share that information really quickly and try to do all that we could to sort of help with the rehab efforts, as well as to sort of document the dead stranding records as well.
So you mentioned that the California sea lion die-off has tapered off and
right.
things are looking better. And
mm-hmm.
is that related to ocean temperatures or ocean conditions in general?
Yeah, it seems to be that whole ecosystem has kind of recovered. It's in the La Nina phase, so you have colder water and more productive water. The sea lion numbers have decreased markedly, so it's a good year to be a sea lion. Yeah.
Lots of food out there. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the sea otters, and that strikes me as really interesting that you found two males. Were they pretty young?
They were. And so one of the strengths of doing this effort-based monitoring or having a great community that works together to report these sorts of things is that some really unusual events are recorded that could have just been missed if people didn't know to call us or if we didn't walk across them in one of our effort-based surveys. So it's really rare to have a sea otter come on the beach. When we found those, they were sent off for genetic analysis, and we found that it was like a young male that was sort of exploring or dispersing from its natal group up in the northern sea otter population. Populations and one that was coming up from the southern. And in the 20 years I've been here, there have been two. So it's not like a mass rush of sea otters, but it's just interesting to find out those. And then you take those samples and send them to NOAA, again, one of our colleagues in the community, and they're able to sort of help us figure out where to go from there.
So sea otters used to live here, but mm-hmm. are these two different species? Or are you just talking about two separate populations?
Two separate populations.
Because they're separated now by this big gap along the coast.
Yeah, there's uh-huh. a really big gap along the coast. And it's separated by those two. This one was from the Monterey area and one was up from around Puget Sound.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you think there's any chance they'll recolonize on their own?
Not in our lifetimes. I think, you know, it may be sometime down the road, but not anytime soon, no.
Why? Or why not? I mean, why would they not be able to? If they're making it here, if they're coming here, I don't really know much about sea otters.
Yeah. I mean, it's the population centers are pretty far away. And those populations are in the southern population is really struggling for lots of different other reasons. And the northern population is doing a little bit better. But I just think that those were kind of errant critters that were dispersing.
Sort of like those European songbird oddballs that get
right.
blown over in a storm and everyone
yeah.
goes crazy for a while. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, this is the Eco News Report. And I'm your host this week, Jennifer Kalt. And I'm talking with Dr. Don Goley, the director of the Humboldt State University Marine Mammal Stranding Program. Let's talk about whales.
Okay.
There are, as you mentioned, many species of whales.
Yeah.
That live here or cruise by the coast here on their way to somewhere else.
Right.
And you study the resident gray whales typically, is that right?
Yes.
How many whales do strand on the beaches around here in the three county area? And have you seen trends since you've been studying them? Or
we've seen in the last 5 years, there have been 8 whales strand. Between 2 to 4 a year is kind of normal. Typically, the whales strand on their way north, on their northern migration. And so just to sort of back up a little bit, the gray whales and the baleen whales have two parts of their life cycle, one where they breed, and that's typically in some warm place like either California or Mexico or Hawaii. And then they travel to their feeding place, which is typically up in Alaska or northern waters. And during that time, they migrate past here. When they're breeding, they're not feeding. So they're fasting that whole time. So sometimes they basically run out of gas on the way north to the feeding grounds. So as they're swimming past, if they didn't have a lot of energy going down to their feeding grounds, they sometimes just die out of starvation on the way back up. So it's not unusual to find whales at this time of the year that are stranding. We had a whale that stranded in Petrolia maybe a month and a half ago, a gray whale. So that's kind of what you'd expect from a normal population of animals that are at or near carrying capacity, that you'd have some die every year. Those are the baleen whales, but there's another group of whales, the toothed whales, that don't necessarily migrate, that are here year-round. So we don't see as many seasonal patterns in those animals. They can happen at any time of year.
The gray whales don't eat while they're swimming by this part of the coast?
Theoretically. So the story, I'll give you the story that used to be. The story used to be that gray whales feed up in the Arctic waters and stuff themselves to the guppers because it's 24 hours of sunlight, lots of productivity. They get really fat and happy, and then they fast and swim all the way down to their breeding grounds where they live off the fat they've accumulated. That was the story. And then when they swim back home, they don't eat until they get to the top. Now, with recent tagging efforts, we found that that's not really true. They nibble along the way here and there. And in fact, Northern California is a great place for them to nibble. We're learning a lot about this migration, which helps us understand some of the stranding patterns. And we're learning more about the stranding patterns, which helps us understand more about the migration. Having said that about gray whales, I want to tell you that there's a special group of gray whales that forego that full migration. And that special group are critters that we've been studying for the last 25 years here at HSU. And those are called the Pacific Coast Feeding Aggregation. They forego the full migration, and they typically spend their summer time from southeast Alaska down to Humboldt County. That's the summer range of this feeding group. And there's been some efforts to understand the genetics of those animals to see if they're a separate population. And there's evidence that they are somewhat genetically separate, but they definitely are behaviorally separate. They definitely have their own group that forages in a separate area than the large group of 20,000 or so that migrate past.
So they're obviously finding something to eat here.
Yeah, there's lots of grub around here for sure. Yeah.
So what do they eat exactly?
So gray whales are thought to be generalists. You can see them feeding on the kelp up around the Rogue River mouth. You can see them feeding on the mud here off the Klamath River or off of Trinidad. They're typically called grubbers. So they go down and they take a big mouthful of mud and they squish it around in their mouth and spit out the mud and water and keep these invertebrates. Much of their diet is composed of invertebrates, worms and amphipods that live just above or in the mud.
That's what the baleen is for. It's like a filter.
Yeah, the baleen. Baleen strains those critters out of the water, either from the mud or out of the kelp, or I've seen them feeding on any number of small schooling things. And this is a really productive area, and so it makes sense that they would be here and found foraging through the summer. It's interesting, we've been studying them for 20 years now, and there are some years where it's just packed with gray whales, and there are some years where you can't find one for anything, and that whole ecosystem is working together in terms of what's available for the whales and what's available for the prey to make that happen.
How do you think whales are doing overall? You consider them at or near carrying capacity.
Yeah.
But many years ago, when there were whaling stations at Trinidad and Fields Landing, I looked through some of the records and they hardly caught any gray whales.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of shocked to realize that in the 1920s that gray whales populations had completely crashed from being hunted.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of talk in various circles about how the Endangered Species Act doesn't work. But what is happening with whales? I mean, they're protected species.
They are. Actually, this came about when I was doing my PhD, and it came up that the gray whales were being put up for delisting. And there was a huge cry from the community, you can't delist them, you have to keep protecting them. And my supervisor, Ken Norris, was one of the main advocates for, no, when the Endangered Species Act works, or when the Marine Mammal Protection Act, in this case, works, you have to sort of let the animals off. I think the gray whales are one of the poster children for the success of these proactive conservation effort for them. And in fact, the Marine Mammal Protection Act has worked well for a number of species. Humpback whales are doing particularly well. It seems that blue whales are doing particularly well. It seems like the whales are coming back pretty well. Some still aren't. On the East Coast, you have the right whale, which is in critically endangered, and largely because of its interactions with the shipping lanes. You have the vaquita, the Gulf of California harbor porpoise that has 30 or fewer animals left, these little tiny harbor porpoise that are enmeshed in this ecological conundrum with fishing down there. There are some animals that will be extinct in our lifetime. Even the Marine Mammal Protection Act or the Endangered Species Act can't help. But for the most part, it's been a really powerful conservation effort that has enabled them to recover.
That makes me want to ask you about the rare whales that you found. I read recently about some sort of a beaked whale that was just sort of accidentally filmed underwater by a student.
Oh, right. Uh-huh.
What are some of the really rare whales that you found washed up on the beach?
Well, we found a pygmy beaked whale. whale. In the last month and a half, we found a Cuvier's beaked whale. Beaked whales are unique in that they're deep diving animals. So even if you're at sea and you're doing multiple day expeditions, it's really rare to see these guys. And so it's quite an exciting scientific discovery to find one on the beach. The pygmy beaked whale that we found, there were very few pictures of it. Not many people even knew what it looked like because it had been identified largely by skeletal remains. And so that's where the new technology of genetics comes into play. And colleagues of ours have been working with us to quickly help to identify the species of critters that we're not sure of. Two of the most exciting new finds are these beaked whales from the depths that we don't know very much about. A pygmy sperm whale was also found recently. So we're looking forward to learning more about them just because we've had this opportunity now that we have a dead carcass to work with. And that might not sound exciting to some people, but the students here at Humboldt State and to other scientists in the community, to even have an opportunity to work with those critters is quite an educational opportunity.
It just highlights how little we know about the oceans, because they're so difficult to study, and rare whales that maybe even experts have only seen once or never.
Right.
So are some of those whales that you just described new sightings for this area, or did people
definitely
know?
Some are new for this area. And we've had some interesting sightings lately of dolphins that are typically really warm water dolphins that I'd see in either Santa Cruz or out in Hawaii that have shown up here on our shores. And the most wonderful thing is that people are walking along the beach and say, hey, I think I found a dolphin, and they don't know the treasure that they've stumbled upon. And if they didn't have the foresight and interest and curiosity to give us a call, we never would have known about them. And so without that kind of outreach from the community, we never would have had that information. So thank you to those folks.
Well, that's a good time to bring up the phone number and how people, if they see something, should they take a picture of it? Should they just call? What do people do?
The most helpful thing is for you to take a photo and to give us a call. And our hotline here at Humboldt State is 707-826-3650. So 826-3650. If you see a dead marine mammal on the beach, give us a call at that hotline number and we'll come out and record information on it. And if you found a live marine mammal that's sick or injured, then you can call the North Coast Marine Mammal Center, 707-951-4722. Those folks will come out and be able to assess the health and well-being of that critter as well. If you happen to be a fisherman or you're out on a boat and you see an entangled whale, there's another number that you can call. It's another group that's for the Entangled Whale Rescue Team, and that's 877-SOS-WHALE, W-H-A-L-E.
People often call Humboldt Baykeeper with all kinds of questions.
Yeah.
Who do I call about this, that, or the other? And we maintain a list of, you know, every possible thing. So that's a good point for listeners. If you see a whale, you can't even tell if it's dead or alive, because actually if it's alive, you're not supposed to get very close to it.
Right.
You can just call Humboldt Baykeeper and we'll figure out how to report it, which place to call. Or you can obviously Google the Marine Mammal Stranding Network.
Yeah, either way works. Any of those numbers, like, we share all of the information with the North Coast Marine Mammal Center and they share it with us too. So we're just really happy to get that information. And if you're there and you'd like to be involved and see what's going on, we welcome participation from the community too.
That brings me to the question, what do you do when you find these dead whales? Then what?
Well, a number of different things. It depends on the flavor of whale. For the harbor porpoise, the animals that are likely to strand every year that we have a number of different specimens for, we record standardized information. And this information is the same information that people from Florida or Maine or Washington collect. And then we put that into the national database so that we can look at stranding patterns for age, sex, length, that sort of thing. We take a series of samples, both for genetics as well as for other samples to share with our neighboring partners too. We try to collect samples of organs and of blubber and of skin. We coordinate with researchers from around the world to help their studies. And so some people are studying hyoid bones, some people are studying blubber contaminants. So we share that information. If there's some indication of human interaction and the animal's in pretty good shape, we tend to do a full autopsy to see if we can determine cause of death. Sometimes you'll see a carcass that has been manipulated by folks from the museum and from our stranding program. That's because we're trying to determine what the cause of death was of that critter.
I would be remiss to not ask you about things like sonar, and you see stories in the news about mass strandings in areas where there's been sonar or underwater explosions and that sort of thing. Tell us a little bit about that.
We had a pilot whale that stranded 10 years ago now, live actually, and then died on the beach. And that's a deep sea offshore whale that could come in contact with sonar testing. So we did take its head and sent it down to the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, and they ran a CAT scan on it to see if it had any injuries. We don't have that ability up here yet. If there's some indication that there's something like that happening, then we do further analysis on it. So when we have something unusual like that, we coordinate with the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, who's coordinating a larger section of the coast. If we had a mass stranding of 40 beaked whales or something like that, that would be super unusual. But the reality is, without doing this effort-based program where we know what the beaches should have, we wouldn't know if it's unusual or not. So now we have a pretty good understanding of what normal stranding patterns are. So if something crazy washes up, or two or three of something crazy washes up, we'll have a better idea about how to deal with that.
So what did they determine was
it the died problem? Of actually an ear and sinus infection. So it's kind of something normal that animals just get sick.
I have to ask you about one of the probably most famous and strangest situations of the Klamath whale that lived in the river for
six weeks. So that was another amazing community effort between the tribe and NIMS and NOAA and HSU. And those whales were actually characterized as being stranded, because a stranded whale or marine mammal is anything out of its natural habitat that is in danger of expiring because of that choice. And that was definitely what happened with those whales. You may know the calf swam out of the river and the mother wasn't able to, and subsequently died in the river. That was, again, an interesting perspective, I think, for both the scientists and the tribe, where you got to really understand each other's perspective and really work as a team. It was a great opportunity for my students, and it was a great opportunity for all of us to get to know each other better and try to affect a change that we weren't able to sort of fully accomplish. And you can identify gray whales by their unique pigmentations on the back. There's a catalog that's kept by Cascadia Research Collective up in Olympia. They've not seen that whale again, and based on any of the survey efforts that have been going along the coast. Not saying that it's not possible, but it hasn't been identified since then.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Klamath Connection Project that you're involved with?
So the Klamath Connection Project is another joint community effort along the coast between the tribes and HSU. It's a way to build a living and learning community at Humboldt for incoming students. And the goal is really to help them find a sense of place and a sense of community. This effort has been spearheaded by Matt Johnson in wildlife and Amy Sprouse in biology. And it's going on its third year now, I think. And so the place we've identified is the Klamath River. So they get to know the Klamath River firsthand by going out there. And they get to know the people of the Klamath River by having that integrated into their curriculum as well as into their extracurricular activities here at HSU. It's really an amazing program, and it's really been really successful in helping students to succeed in ways that they haven't in the past. And a lot of that has to come by really understanding more about this amazing watershed that we're a part of and this community that we're a part of with all of its components.
That is really cool, because when I was an undergrad, I had a lot of professors who had lived here for decades, but they didn't have a lot of connection to the local area. They did research elsewhere during the summers. A lot of them would go back to wherever they had done their PhD research. So they, in class, would talk about, you know, Michigan or Canada or Oregon or whatever. And it's great to have that knowledge and expertise about other areas, but it's also really gratifying to have that connection to the local area, because I moved here because I wanted to live here.
Right.
I wasn't just a short-term visitor coming to college and then going to rush off as soon as I was graduated from college. So that seems like a really great way to connect people with, you know, the area that they're living.
It's significant, because there are a lot of students now that are coming from Southern California, and Northern California is a fairly foreign land for them. But when you get introduced to the treasures and the different people that are here, it creates a bond that's kind of unbreakable. And they get connected not only with their environment through understanding the Klamath and the folks that live there, but they get connected with the department, and they get connected with the resources here. And you get to see that science is really just a community, right? That science can't be done in a vacuum, that it has to be done together. And that's the strength of the Klamath Connection, and that's the strength of the Marine Environmental Stranding Network. That's the strength of our community, is that scientists all come together to solve problems in ways that you don't see in other communities. So I'm super proud to be a part of all of this and happy to be a part of our community with you, Jen.
Well, that is a great way to wrap up the show. Thanks so much for being here today, Dawn.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been really interesting.
Thank you.
And speaking of scientist communities, I just want to announce the March for Science that's going to be coming up on Earth Day, April 22nd. Here in Arcata, we're going to have a science expo at the D Street Neighborhood Center in Arcata from, I believe it is 9 to 1:30, that the public is all welcome to come and see a variety of different types of science research, science, technology, all kinds of science that's going on in our community, from science fair projects from elementary school to college students' posters to tribal scientific projects and research that they're doing, all kinds of different agencies and nonprofits, just celebrating science and recognizing how important science is for pretty much every aspect of our lives. And then there will be a rally with a range of speakers, and then there will be a march through downtown Arcata. So it is a nonpartisan event that is meant to celebrate science, the importance of science, and to have everyone who supports science come and really gather together to show our support and the need for science in modern life. And lastly, one very important thing to mention is that this is harbor seal pupping season, and it's not uncommon to see harbor seal pups alone, and that's because their mother is out feeding, and it's very important to keep your dogs away, leave them where you found them, and she needs to find them where she left them. So if you are worried about a harbor seal pup and you think it might be sick or injured, definitely want to keep your distance, but you can call 707-951-4722, and the North Coast Marine Mammal Center will send someone out to check on it. This has been the Eco News Report. My name is Jennifer Kaltz of Humboldt Baykeeper, and I've been your host for the past half hour. I was speaking with Dr. Dawn Goley of the Humboldt State University Marine Mammal Stranding Program. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 707-826-6089. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the KHSU archives at khsu.org. And now we're podcasting. You can subscribe at iTunes and leave us a review. Previous shows are also posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. The Eco News Report is produced at Humboldt State University in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. Join us again next week for the Eco News Report.